Hello, my name is Alice Yandel, and welcome to the latest in our Professional Partnerships Business in Common podcast. In this series, we're talking to specialists around the firm about how they apply their particular skills when acting for professional firms and their partners. I'm a senior associate in our employment team, and today I'm speaking with Erin O'Rourke, a partner in our IP and commercial team, who specialises in all things data related. Erin, thanks very much for joining me. One of the things which often comes across my desk when acting for professional firms and their partners, certainly on the employment side, are data subject access requests, or DSARs. So for example, coinciding with a potential partner expulsion or where litigation post-exit's in contemplation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, not just in an HR context or partnership dispute, it can be a complaint about professional services, for example.
Yeah, and to some extent, I guess, this is just something everyone in businesses, you know, is having to grapple with now. But in a partnership context specifically, it does raise a number of interesting data protection questions. And it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on those, Erin. So one of the things which, you know, comes to mind for me is how, for example, people go about grappling with the issue of who the data controller is when a DSAR has been made and why that issue matters.
So for an incorporated partnership, the position is pretty straightforward. The incorporated entity will be the data controller. But data protection law isn't tied to a very corporate way of looking at things. An individual professional, a natural person, can be a data controller if that's how they run their business. So in this way, an unincorporated body of professionals can be a group of individual self-employed data controllers, or it can be a single collective data controller, or it can be both at the same time. So if you look at a barrister's chambers, for example, each barrister is a self-employed data controller responsible for determining how and where and why they hold client data. But their chambers, however it is structured, is also likely to be a data controller, which employs clerks and support staff. And a subject access request could be made to either or both. Plus, barristers are often also asked to sit on investigation panels or conduct reviews on behalf of clients and sitting alongside others too. So I think the question of who holds data on behalf of whom can quickly become quite complicated. I mean, this may seem like quite an arcane issue on paper, but it goes beyond just paying a fee and putting out a privacy notice. At the business end, it can determine where liability sits for a fine, or, you know, against whom an aggrieved person should seek a remedy or exercise a right. And it can take an issue like a partner or an employee suffering a terrible data breach or someone putting in a subject access request to bring the issue to life. Like, it makes you ask the question of, well, who actually determines what data the partnership holds and why, and whether you will collective responsibility for it. It's hard to see many positives in receiving a subject access request. You just have to get on with them. But it can hold a useful mirror to your business practices and your data structure. You know, and who's using WhatsApp or personal devices or their own email accounts to carry out partnership business? How is this reflected in your working practices? Are there written policies around it? This all feeds into important questions relation to DSARs, like, you know, what searches will you need to make to fulfill a request? What nasty surprises will there be in your searches? And what might the fallout be with the individual? But it also plays into more top-level questions.
Yeah, that makes sense, Erin. And I guess one of the things which might be useful for us just to talk about a bit more, because I know certainly my clients, they see the word DSAR and they think, oh my goodness, heart attack type moment here. You know, just bring it back to the practical reality of dealing with one of those requests. You know, what can professional partnerships do, you know, to try and make compliance with them as proportionate and as manageable as possible, particularly if they're dealing with numerous requests at one go?
Yeah, I think the first point is to take your time if you can. I mean, the ICO may not like that because you're meant to respond promptly and in any event, technically within 1 month. And undoubtedly, there will be times when it is both possible and advisable to do so. And I think if a request is urgent in nature or narrow, or at least you can interpret it narrowly, or perhaps if the requester is willing to meet you halfway, then maybe you can draw the sting of the dispute and perhaps resolve the matter without going to wider lengths by producing what really matters to them quickly. But I think equally, sometimes it is clear when you get a subject access request, in fact, you're settling into the first steps of an extended legal dance with a requester. They may not be willing to discuss narrowing the request, and it may not even be worth asking. It may be better to make your own robust calls about what they're really asking for, what they're really interested in on the basis of the request as written, or just given your wider knowledge of the circumstances. Just work out for yourself, well, what are we prepared to do by way of searches, and just present wherever you end up as your response without necessarily asking permission. And if the requester was expecting more, well, they can specify what and where to find it. But I think at that stage, you're likely to be arguing over much more limited ground. Whereas I think giving them a chance to be bloody about it and disruptive by checking whether or not they definitely want absolutely everything. I mean, if there's already bad blood, they're only going to double down, I think, on wanting you to do as much as possible for them. So, I mean, I think in any event, the types of employment, HR or partnership dispute concerns of the sort you've raised, Alice, are almost invariably, in my experience, complex enough to justify a statutory right of extension from 1 month to three. Now, complainants may not like that, their lawyers may not like it, but remember that this right was not invented as a quick route to litigation disclosure. We can't stop claimants, grieved people, using subject access the way they use it now in disputes. I think the courts and guidance are pretty clear about that, but we can say, well, hold on, if you want us to go through thousands of emails, then that's just going to take as long as it takes. And more negative consequences have arisen, in my experience, by clients rushing DSAR responses than by requesters successfully complaining about timescales.
There are a couple of really interesting points, Sarah, and I just wanted to pick up on for the audience. So firstly, mostly we do see DSARs, or certainly in my experience, where there is a complaint or legal claim alongside the request. So were you saying that it's irrelevant to whether a DSAR is valid or not?
Yeah, I think in terms of whether you can actually refuse to play ball, you know, altogether and refuse a request, I mean, generally motive is only a factor in very extreme cases where you can show malicious efforts to cause disruption and harassment to your business, or targeting particular individuals, you know, disruption for its own sake, or perhaps to put financial pressure on you to make settlement. So, you know, in other words, if you can clearly show that somebody does not actually appear interested in getting their own data, then you can argue, well, yes, that request is perhaps manifestly unfounded and I can refuse it or charge for it. But I think generally the nuclear option of saying no dice, sorry, is far more likely to end up with you being in front of the ICO or even a court application eventually. So I think even in a litigation scenario where your strategy is hard line, in UK GDPR terms, it's far better to cover your position to some extent by showing you took your compliance obligations seriously and provided something within the reasonable range of responses within a reasonable time. I think you don't want to face allegations that you were victimizing this person because of a dispute or something they said or reported, you know, the whistleblower argument, or some other form of potentially unlawful discrimination being played out in how you respond to their subject access request. You want to be able to show that you dealt with a request more or less how you deal with a request from anyone else, but proportionately.
You hear that word a lot, but I know for a lot of clients, these kinds of requests don't always feel proportionate. They feel hugely disproportionate.
No, it is very, very burdensome. And I always like to stress to clients, I didn't invent this law, but I'm just there to try and help them through it. I think, you know, the word proportionality is important because this is fundamentally, it's still an EU law concept. GDPR is at origin EU law, even if there's a chance we may begin to diverge from it in some ways in coming years and how the courts interpret it. But sometimes in high value or emotive disputes, you have no option but to roll your sleeves up and spend time and money doing a very thorough job, and anything else can be a false economy. But going back to this idea of proportionality, I also think people can sometimes overestimate the regulatory response to missing a particular deadline or making some pretty robust decisions about what searches you are prepared to undertake and where you draw the line in terms of what you search and what you're prepared to actually provide. I think all the case law and enforcement record, you know, although there is a lack of consistency and predictability in some of these cases, and particularly around technical questions about, well, you know, disagreement about what is actually personal data, really, what are the limits of proportionality? Yeah, there's plenty of debate around that, but at the same time, the body of case law and regulatory approaches kind of point to a pretty similar picture in terms of what are the basic rules of engagement. And that is, you know, the lesson is do more than nothing. If you refuse to comply or refuse to engage, then you are going to get in trouble with the court or regulator. But if you can show you go to some reasonable length to turn out your pockets, you keep the requester informed about the reasoning for where you drew the line, I think then you'll find that there's really quite a wide spectrum of reasonable and proportionate responses to a subject access request that will be held lawful.
So what about these 20 million euro mega fines we keep reading about?
Yeah, I think, you know, they are a thing. The ICO has teeth. These fines do occur, or at least not to that level in the UK, but they are getting larger. So I don't want to play down that risk. But what I would say in a subject access scenario, the main focus of regulators is currently, as it has been for a while, on commercial uses of data. Maybe cross-border issues are becoming a big thing with European regulators particularly, but mainly it's been old-fashioned dodgy marketing practices and big data breaches where the fines have been attracted. So when it comes to subject access, the ICO receives thousands of complaints about these every month. It's not an area of compliance that they can even afford to prioritize if they wanted to. So the last thing the overburdened ICO caseworker wants to do is get in broiled in an e-sign dispute between partners over exactly who said what in an email and who's entitled to see what document. And you're certainly not the first time of asking. I think it might be months before the ICO do respond, and then they'll encourage the parties to fix it, you know, without the ICO's involvement. So chances are, by the time the ICO find the resources to get around and actually deal with a DSAR complaint, you will have provided some kind of substantive response to the requester, and hopefully you will be on the road with them to working out how to resolve the broader dispute that probably sits behind the request. So I think this of the technical UK GDPR breaches of deadlines and queries about your exact approach to disclosure, I think these will only remain live issues in most cases if the parties are just so far apart in their overall position that they're still firing off long legal letters months later about what they think are the key documents.
So switching then to another data-related issue, but one also with IP elements, which I know is another area of your specialism, Owen. Some things which often come up during partner exit are things like access to database, who owns particular contacts and so on, either in the context of restrictive covenants in their contracts of employment, or a partner perhaps working out their notice or secretly planning an exit, accessing confidential information and then sending that either to themselves or disseminating it outside the partnership. Now, there are obviously lots of legal issues to dissect there, and I'm, you know, conscious of time, but in brief terms, how can partnerships best protect themselves and their confidential information? And have you got any top tips on steps they should be taking if it becomes apparent a partner may be misusing or attempting to misuse confidential information?
Yeah, and although the law of confidential information is very different to the law of personal data, and you know, this is an area where we in Europe and the UK view things differently to the kind of historic view prevalent in the US, for example, of someone else's personal data as business property as opposed to seeing the individual's rights. Although they are different areas of law, nevertheless, they can overlap. So, you know, a customer database is proprietary. It's protected in various different ways by IP law and law of confidence. But once that database is broken up, extracted in someone's memory or spread out across different accounts and devices and, you know, your email address book, it becomes harder to trace or control where that information has gone. So, we could go into some detail on contractual protections with partners and employees, and you know, these are by and large necessary and often effective means to sort of pin clear rules and an understanding on what people may take with them and who they may or may not do business with. So I don't want to do down the importance of those terms and negotiating them properly, but I would draw a parallel with what I said before about security of structure. So it's not just ability at an IT level to encrypt or protect data or to detect when it's being accessed or sent out of the building. It's also about how your systems are built in terms of access permissions, how your partnership is structured at a policy level. So for example, if partners are allowed to use home devices and personal emails routinely, for example, it rapidly becomes harder to police from a data security level, but also from a proprietary information level. So I think, you know, culturally, it may be more important to you to trust those you work with as grown-ups, and that is fine. I would say that the planning for tidy exits begins with your day-to-day hygiene in terms of digital systems in particular.
Thank you, and certainly lots to digest, but it sounds like, you know, pragmatism is the key in navigating what are, you know, very complex areas of law.
That's how we try to do it, yes.